Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up later in the show, Screen Time with Steph Curtis. But now we're in depth on whether you can really get ahead in the gig economy. I took Uber from the airport last weekend. My driver was in his mid-20s, piecing together three gigs so he could pay for his boxing training at a local gym. He's part of a segment of American workers that grew from 10.1% in 2005 to 15.8% in 2015. They are freelancers, independent contractors, part-timers, and on-call employees. And as Chris Farrell pointed out to me recently, they're much cheaper for companies to employ. But gig workers are anxious about job security, about the benefits they often don't have, about their futures, and they're contributing to an overall unease about the economy. As our guests join us this morning, I'd love to hear from you, too. If you're part of the gig economy, working as a freelancer, indie contract employee, part-timer, is this how you want to work? Or are you doing it until you can find the right job for the right money? Does being a gigger add to your stress about the future? So we want to hear this morning about your experience as being part of the gig economy. Of course, from the Uber and Lyft drivers to the contract employees to freelance writers to, I mean, you know who you are. If you're part of that gig economy, it'd be great to hear, have the benefit of your experience in the conversation here. Talk to me this morning about it, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Chris Farrell writes about economics for Marketplace and other magazines, and he has a forthcoming article on the gig economy in Yes Magazine. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks a lot.
Fiona Grieg is with us. She's director of consumer research for the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute. She's co-author of a study on the gig economy, and we will tweet out a link to the study. It's called Paychecks, Paydays, and the Online Platform Economy. She's with us from Washington. Fiona, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Carrie.
You know, Chris, I thought we'd bring some of these gig workers into focus. Give me an idea about the kind of jobs you're doing and the kind of skills that are really incorporated. These are not necessarily low-skilled jobs in the gig economy.
Not necessarily. And what we're focusing on is labor, the people who are doing the work. Because there's another kind of gig economy. It comes under that rubric, which is like Airbnb. You own your own home and you rent it out for short-term periods of time. But the gig economy's gathered so much attention because here's people, the Uber Lyft drivers, the classic, but it's also graphic designers. It can be all kinds of people with high-tech skills that are part of this contingent workforce that you mentioned. And this contingent workforce is very entrepreneurial. There are some real benefits to it. But at the same time, the concern is they don't have a lot of labor market protection, such as, you know, just think about saving for retirement. You know, most of us and most Americans, the only way they save for retirement is if they have access to an employer-sponsored retirement savings plan.
Right.
Well, gig economy workers don't. Contingent labor doesn't have that. Health insurance, they don't get their health insurance through their employer. Unemployment insurance, they don't have access to unemployment insurance when they lose their jobs. So this is one of the gig economy has become the visible focus of this growing contingent workforce. The gig economy itself is relatively small.
Fiona, I'm curious about whether some of the jobs that are now being filled by gig economy workers were one-time, full-time jobs before the Great Recession.
Well, you know, I think our work can't answer that directly. I mean, I would agree with Chris that there are a number of different sectors that are represented here on the in terms of labor platforms. It could be ride sharing. It could be various forms of care, dog walking, pet sitting, that sort of thing. In terms of capital platforms, it could be, you know, the eBays, the Etsys, the where you're selling goods or renting assets. And so, you know, the incumbent industries here are obviously the taxi and limousine sectors, transportation in general, restaurants, where we might be, you know, ordering in rather than going to a restaurant. And, you know, on the capital side, it's obviously the hotel industry. So it could be that people are switching in and out of these industries, or they might be coming, the vast majority of people that we observe have some main job, and these gigs are really a side gig, and they are a secondary source of income for people. So it may not necessarily be the case that people are actually quitting their main job to do this. They could be between jobs, or sort of organically, or they could be just doing these gigs on the side.
I wanted to ask you something, Fiona, about something that appears in this report, this study that you published. It kind of, I think, hints at an upside, and then we've talked a little bit about the downside. It says, rapidly growing online platforms have created a new marketplace for work by unbundling a job into discrete tasks and directly connecting individual sellers with consumers. I mean, that sounds like the upside of this.
That's right. I think that's one of the things that is quite disruptive, as they say, about the online platform economy and these gigs, is that you really are being paid on a piece rate basis, and that gives workers tremendous flexibility. They can turn the apps on, they can turn them off, and so they can work when they want. And with that comes, you know, a payment mechanism where they're really being paid for a task at a time, or the sale of a single good at a time. And so that flexibility is a boon to people who want to try and, you know, find additional income on the side.
Chris, let me come to you in just a second here, yeah. But we have an Uber driver on the line right now. So
sure.
I want to hear what his experience is. To Aaron in Minneapolis. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Going well. Talk to us about being part of this gig economy.
Well, I've been working with Uber for about the past 7 months now, and I do it as a supplementary job, so I work it on weekends and evenings and stuff like that.
Okay.
And overall, it's a great gig. The only problem comes in when you actually need to talk to the company, or when you need to directly interact with what would be considered like your boss.
Really?
Because I've had certain times where the Uber accounts will get canceled for us drivers, and they won't tell you why. And then all of a sudden, we have to go through and try to figure it out. Well, if it's after hours, we have no one to talk to.
Yeah, I mean,
so
this,
we're stuck basically not making money for the night.
Yeah, this is kind of what it's like to interact with this online platform that looks great until you, as he says, need to interact, Chris.
Absolutely. And these are all the kinds of fascinating issues that are arising as this labor market does grow. And there is all this upside. And I think it was really important what Fiona was saying about supplementing income. And, you know, all of us, I mean, journalists just do this. We talk to people. So, when I was in Chicago and took an Uber, it was a teacher and he was supplementing, he was saving for his daughter's retirement. And I was recently in Washington, D.C. It was a young man and he was planning on getting married. So he wanted a down payment for a home and he was driving to do that. And this is wonderful that this has been added to the workforce. At the same time, we do have this overall trend. If you think about what a lot of companies are doing, is they're trying to limit their full-time workforce.
Right.
And this is the workforce that allows you to plan. It allows you to save for your retirement. It allows you to tap into your health insurance if something goes wrong in terms of you're ill. And they're hiring more and more contingent workers, independent contractors. And so these people are sort of floating out there. And the more this becomes a way of life, and some people embrace it. This is what they want to be. They want to be an independent entrepreneur. But other people, they embrace it, but they want some of the protections of our social safety net that really those protections largely assume. If you look at labor law and you look at our social safety net, it largely assumes that you work for one company. You work for that company for a long period of time.
The way it's set up now, you're
the way
saying.
It's set up
yeah.
now. And yet there are more and more people, depending on which statistics you're looking at, there are more and more people who don't have access to that safety net.
Two questions about that, Fiona. And Marie in Minneapolis here kind of reflecting this. She says, took a severance package from her job about 6 years ago, has been doing gig economy for about as long as an HR professional. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
She can gig economy on HR. So to what Chris said, though, does this, Fiona, allow companies to shed what would be more of these full-time jobs because they can bring in these more task-oriented employees, and maybe those jobs never come back, you know, to those companies? Is that one of the consequences of this?
Well, I think we're seeing an overall growth in the contingent workforce and a shift towards contract-based work across the economy. And, you know, that's sort of independent of this gig economy and the rise of these platforms, where you see more of the work in, say, a hotel being intermediated with, you know, contracts and subcontractors as opposed to full-time employees. And I think that rise has been occurring over the course of the last decade, where the surface of this online platforms is a much more recent thing. So the two are connected, and the platforms are maybe an extension of that and may further exacerbate or accelerate that trend. So, yes, they could be connected.
Well, and here's why I ask. I see Betsy here on Twitter who says, got laid off in 2010, been freelancing as a writer ever since, can't find full-time employment, companies fear commitment. And Fiona, if companies fear commitment and they can get enough, you know, contract gig workers, they really don't have to commit to one of those benefits given 401k invested kind of positions, do they?
Well, I would want to temper that statement with a long-term view of the employee that most firms hold, which is, you know, you need to invest in your employees in order to develop them and to have them perform. And so I think, this online platform work is raising a bunch of questions also about, you know, what is the form of investments that firms should be making or can be making in the future into their employees. And I don't think this kind of Tetris economy where you can just sort of substitute in some contractor for any job is really true across the labor market. And in certain sectors, obviously you need people with great experience and with great firm level experience.
Yeah, I guess trying to get a sense here, Chris, not that all companies are going to go to all contract, we're obviously not, but are they relieved of beefing up their full-time employees because of what Betsy's telling us and some of the other people here?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the larger corporations, what larger corporations are really trying to do is not add that many employees during the good times and not lay off that many employees to the bad times. So when you have good times and there's that urge to hire, what they oftentimes do is they'll bring back former retirees, boomerang retirees, have them do some contract work. They'll bring back some contractors, perhaps they used to work with them, but they bring them back to work on specific jobs. They'll work with temp agencies, and then they will gradually increase their employment if the good times last long enough. But basically, companies really are trying to have a fairly stable employment. And then what the contract workforce allows for is when times get tough or you got to sort of tighten your belt, those are the first people that you're going to either you're going to go instead of paying them in 30 days, you pay them in 90 days. And then when you've gone through that, then you just decide you're going to get rid of them.
Christine says on Twitter, husband just started a gig this week after 9 months off. It's horribly unpredictable and they're the first ones out. Hate it. Steph off the page.
Lisa says, I've worked as an independent contractor for a major publisher for about 12 years, starting after I had health problems that made it hard to manage a 9-to-5. I like working at home and the people with whom I work remotely, but the ups and downs are incredibly stressful. My fees have never gone up, and for some work, the fees are less than before 2008. Finally, tax issues may be the last straw. Self-employed folks pay an extra 15.3% tax, and this year, 40% of my $55,000 went to taxes and no benefits. And then she has a sad face.
To Christine in Minneapolis on the phone lines. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I'm coming at this from kind of a different side.
Okay.
I worked full-time in higher education for 12 years, and about 3.5 years ago, I left it to start my independent professional organizing business. And it's very full-time. I work more hours than I did before, but not having the stress of trying to work with bosses and trying to get, you know, if I want to make a change on my website, I just do it. I don't have to email somebody and make an appointment. And, you know, 3 weeks later, we still haven't done anything.
All
and
the
I'm
bureaucracy.
On the next
thing. Yes.
And the stress that is gone from that is enormous. And I hope I never have to go back to traditional employment. And whenever I hear people complaining about their jobs, I always just want to say, why can't you go self-employed? But I realize not everyone can.
Fiona, does some of that emerge in this study that you put together?
Well, certainly, you know, one of the callers mentioned income volatility in general, and I just want to put this in the context of that, which is that we are seeing a rise in income volatility generally over the last decade, and incomes are very volatile. And so, you know, part of that rise in income volatility could be due to the rise of you know, this contract space, and it could be due to volatility in hours in general, even in regular W-2 or part-time work. So I think this is emerging in the context of what are very rocky financial lives that people are experiencing, especially as, of course, we're all coming out of the Great Recession. So there's a larger context that I want to put this in. But, you know, one thing that I think is also important is that the earnings from these labor platforms in particular, they can offset dips in non-platform income. Yeah. And we do actually see that happening in our data. You know, we found 260,000 people who had earned income off of these 30 different platforms. And among those who had earned income off of labor platforms, their earnings from their non-platform work was about, you know, 14 percentage points lower in the months when they were actively earning on these platforms. And the earnings from those platforms actually made up that difference and made them whole, gave them that extra 14% to even things out. So, you know, that is a bit of the upside, that in a world where incomes are volatile, people are able to, you know, offset the dips that they might experience or create more income with which to offset, you know, surges in expenses might also experience.
Yeah, although, Chris, I would say, and that does sound like the kind of safety net you want to know you can have. That said, I mean, in an economy where wages have been stagnant, to say, well, to really make it, now I have to go out and work another 20 hours a week, you know, to give my family security, is not necessarily the way you imagined your work life would be.
No, but I would, you know, but you want to change jobs. You've had it with the boss. You have had it with this job, as the previous person was saying. You want to be doing something different. And of course, we're always saying, well, you have to have savings, and savings will help you tide you over while you find a new job. This provides an alternative. It's a way of thinking about, okay, maybe you don't have the savings.
Right.
Most of us never do have the savings, right?
Yeah.
We put it on the credit card. This is an alternative. And I think that is an important point, that this sort of, if you're making one of these transitions, career transitions, job transitions, this adds to your arsenal of choices of how to make that transition work and still be able to pay the bills that we have to do. But where people get upset, and I think rightly get upset, is what you're just talking about in terms of this overall economy. There's this growing sense, look, there haven't been wage increases, and there's a great deal of sense of insecurity and this sort of financial insecurity that we're all living with. And so this gig economy works to the extent that it is short term, to the extent that it is supplemental. But as these platforms become a deeper part of our economy, and as these platforms are connected to this growing contingent workforce, then some of those longer term issues come to the fore. And I think it actually adds to people's sense of insecurity.
Chris Farrell, one of our guests this morning, if you've tuned in to hear us talking about the gig economy, what it means, as Chris is suggesting, as it deepens its presence in our economy, what it means for the workers, what it means for companies that are setting up more of these gigs, and what it means overall for the kind of income and benefit security that many of us still get through full-time work. Chris, a guest, Fiona Grieg with us. She's director of consumer research for the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, and they recently did a study on this. And hearing from you this morning, and this is great, if you're part of the gig economy, working as a freelancer, a contingent worker, a contract employee, a part-timer, I want to know, is this how you want to work? I mean, is this set up the way you planned it out? Or are you doing this in some ways by necessity? So if that's the case, upside, downside of that necessity, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR, where Barbara says, husband joined a gig at the height of the recession, freelance writer, gives guitar lessons, plays gigs, and started the happy dog walker. And at NPRnews.org/live, Steph.
Lucy says, I was an occupational therapy practitioner for 43 years. I was let go at age 59. I'm now an independent private home care provider. Not really what I want to do, but I fear this may be the best for pay and independence.
And then Betsy comes back here and says, it's a tough way of life. Zero security equals high stress. Can't plan for the future. Retirement savings is a fairy tale. Fiona, I wonder if you would just speak to that, those questions she's raising.
Yeah, I mean, we see that in the months when people are earning, they earn roughly $533 a month on from labor platforms and $314 a month on capital platforms. Again, when people are actually active and they're coming in and out, they're not necessarily steadily earning income. So $533 isn't enough to, you know, live on and save for retirement. It is, however, typically extra cash on top of their usual income or their non-platform income. And, you know, that is, you know, whether people can use it to cover expenses that they need that month or whether they put it away for retirement, I guess that's up to them. But, you know, it is not that much money actually right now.
To the phones to Tina in Minneapolis. Hi, Tina.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for waiting. Tell me how this works in your life.
Well, I guess I'm a graphic designer. I am a contingent worker. And to me personally, it's almost a sense of being used where they kind of need you when they need you, and then they're like, okay, well, you know, really, they don't really need you anymore. We're going to let you go. Hmm. And you're back home on unemployment at a quarter or a third of what you were paid, mm-hmm. trying to make your bills, and then you try and find another job, hopefully a full-time job at that point. But then times get hard, and then you are like, well, I gotta do what I gotta do, and you go back to freelancing or, you know, finding a job through an agency or whatever it is. So it's really difficult. And like everybody says, it's no security. I mean, I'm only 28, but I have a new family, and it's really hard to plan. Just like everybody's saying, it's hard to plan and it's hard to support a family when, you know, you're like, my husband doesn't have health insurance and I don't get health insurance.
Wow.
Through it. So like, what do you like, there's a lot of things that are up in the air and it's really hard. And the hard thing is that I'm penalized for, it's almost like I'm penalized for not having health insurance. You know, it's the whole thing, like, I don't have health insurance, I need health insurance, but I can't afford health insurance, and it's a really big tickle, especially for retirement and all of the above.
Yeah, I really appreciate the call, Tina. Chris and I both winced when we heard about the no health insurance.
Well, this is obviously part of a much bigger issue, a much bigger conversation, and this was the impetus behind the Affordable Care Act. There are some flaws to the Affordable Care Act, but you know, I'm in the camp that believes the Affordable Care Act needs to be improved to reflect just her circumstance, Tina's circumstances, and lots of the people that we're talking about in the contingent workforce in terms of having portable, accessible, comprehensive insurance coverage that you don't, which was what a lot of people get through their employer. But if you work for a small business, if you're self-employed, if you're a contingent worker, you typically don't. And what are your choices? What are your access? And that's where we need to have a lot of improvement.
One of the things that, Chris, you and I were talking about before this show was the anger that emerges out of, I think we heard the frustration with the economy.
Yeah.
Some of the anger that's being expressed in this presidential race. I think we heard a little bit of that from Tina, but I was reading something that David Dayan wrote about it in the New Republic in April, and he writes, who is, by the way, part of the gig economy? So he's writing this from a first-person point of view. He says, the way the 1099 economy is sold, with airy platitudes about freedom and being your own boss, doesn't correspond to the very real anxiety of this type of arrangement. And among other things, he adds, you have no advocates for you in the workplace and little bargaining power to improve your lot. I think Tina was also saying that in some ways you kind of feel used, needed when you're needed, discarded when you're not. I can see why that builds some of this frustration we're seeing about the economy.
I mean, there are many ways of looking at the labor market over the past 30 years, but I think it's really fair to say that over the past 30 years, the worker, the average worker, the typical worker has lost voice. They have lost leverage in the workplace. And that does fuel anger. It's a lack of control, to the lack of sense that there's a power imbalance. And there is a power imbalance there. And so this is part of the concerns that's being raised. So again, the gig economy itself, relatively small, kind of intriguing, offers a lot of options. You can kind of really see the promise that is in this gig economy, but it's these uncertainties, it's this lack of power that, again, feed into, okay, so how far does this go? And it's tapping into much larger issues about the overall contingent workforce.
Fiona, can I ask you to speak to what Chris just said about the worker losing leverage and where this might fit in there?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I want to make an important distinction, I think, between this idea of deepening versus growth.
Okay.
Because we are seeing tremendous growth in the percent of adults who have earned income from the gig economy. Tenfold growth in the percent over a course of 3 years who are earning income in any given month. However, we are not seeing growth in the percent of people who are relying on this as the primary source of their income. So we are not actually seeing a deepening. It is not the case that those who are participating in this are relying on it more and more and more.
Good to know.
Right. And so I think that speaks to, you know, some of the limitations, right, that we're hearing about from our listeners and otherwise about the lack of benefits, the volatility, the lack of, the uncertainty, et cetera, that puts kind of an upper bound on how much people are really willing to rely on this, and that they do fully understand that the best solution is to get a real job or to get a full-time job, and that this needs to, at this point, probably remain a side thing.
But to what I said earlier about that, which is, did you imagine your work life, you know, making up for stagnant income or, you know, I don't know, benefits that you don't have that you need to find income somewhere else to invest in? I mean, is this really the way you imagined your work life, adding another 15 to 20 hours a week to make it work? That's a fair question, isn't it?
I think that's a very fair question and something worth considering and hopefully addressing, you know, through minimum wage increases that we're seeing across the country and different efforts to actually improve the fundamentals of the labor force.
Jeremy says on Twitter, I've been freelance in advertising for about 13 years. Get a great accountant for taxes and a spouse with benefits. That's the healthcare piece of that. Again,
well, that's
Chris.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that is actually how a lot of people do it.
Right. And Steph off the page.
Krista says, I've been a freelance worker at an advertising agency for several years.
We're hearing from a lot of people in advertising and design on this.
She says, of course, there are many ups and downs doing freelance work. One of my biggest issues is being treated as an other by full-time employees. I work very hard and have taken on more responsibility each year without a pay increase. I expect to get more respect for my work ethic, not my label.
Call here from Marcy, listening in Eden Prairie. Hi, Marcy. How's the gig economy work for you?
Well, so far so good, but I certainly have my complaints. What I do is I sell my services as a digital content writer specializing in search engine optimization. And that's been very rewarding, a lot of challenge. I get to really explore organization and helping users get through a given digital experience. But the downside really, of course, is the instability. And I've heard this coming up over and over again in the conversations that you've been having, and I'm here to back it up completely. I'm one of the lucky ones. I have a great network, and I have great work that I get to do. And sometimes I have too much work, and I have the joy of networking with other people and getting them other opportunities that they can explore. So that's great, but there are no protections, and that is something that I and a lot of people like me really struggle with.
we are going by luck and by the whims of the people who, well, not whims, sorry, but to put it more accurately, we're going through sometimes the whims, but also through the needs and, like, the wishes of the people, like, that we're working for.
Like the temporary needs, right? Of
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, without any of those protections in place, we're kind of always using our inner resourcefulness to try to find what might be around the corner. So, you know, say we're getting called by somebody else. Do you have something else going on? The answer might be, I don't know. What do you have, you know, that you might need me for, just in case this one falls through? And it has happened to me and to several people I know where overnight, literally overnight, you'll be taken off work and you may not have a very clear idea why. I have several friends who are attorneys. And, you know, one thing that I have been told is that over, I think it's the past 20 years, I don't know, somebody correct me on that if I'm not right about that, but there are some statutes that have been altered to increasingly empower employers to hire and to fire. This includes contract workers, of course.
Marcy, let me do this. One of the places that I want to go in this conversation is something that Senator Elizabeth Warren has proposed recently, which is called Strengthening the Basic Bargain for Workers in the Modern Economy. And those are some protections that she's working on. So why don't we get a look at the latest news? We'll come back and talk a bit about what Marcy said. Chris Farrell, Fiona Grieg continue with us. And your calls and your questions as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Love hearing from you on Twitter here. It's at @CarrieMPR. To Phil Picardi now with the latest. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Police officials say a terrorism investigation is underway after a car parked near Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris was found with 7 gas canisters inside. They say the car was found Sunday morning along the Seine River with its hazard lights on. It had no license plates and no one inside. 6 canisters filled with gas were found in the trunk and an empty one in the car. An official says the couple that owned the car has been taken into custody. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is accusing Russia of nuclear saber-rattling. In a speech today at Britain's Oxford University, Carter said Russia is eroding the principled international order through coercion and aggression. And Carter says Russia is trying to sow instability beyond its borders, including in the Middle East. Carter said he wants Russia to take a more constructive role in Syria to arrange a lasting ceasefire. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is in Philadelphia this morning to unveil a plan for a major increase in defense spending. The address at Philadelphia's Union League will outline his plans to eliminate deep military cuts that were enacted when Congress failed to reach a budget compromise in 2011. Tonight, Trump and Hillary Clinton both talk about national security at an NBC Commander-in-Chief forum in New York. And parts of Arizona and New Mexico could be hit with dangerous rains from Tropical Storm Newton today. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says Newton made landfall on Mexico's mainland overnight and is on its way to the U.S. border. The storm's winds were last tracked at 70 miles an hour. Early yesterday, Newton made landfall as a hurricane near Mexico's Los Cabos resorts. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
After 27 years, the Jacob Wetterling case is solved.
Danny Heinrich is no longer a person of interest. He is the confessed murderer of Jacob Wetterling.
We'll have reaction and all the day's news. Join me for All Things Considered starting at 3.
If you're one of those gig workers and you've got a gig, so you can't listen to the rest of the show, you can always find us on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller in iTunes. You'll find a lot of political conversations there, too. I mean, the thing we talked about yesterday with education and voter behavior, always there on the podcast. NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the Fitzgerald Theater, bringing the radio experience to the stage with programs like A Prairie Home Companion, Films at the Fitz, and Talking Volumes. More information online at FitzgeraldTheater.org. Support for this program comes from the Level 1 Pediatric Trauma Center at HCMC, offering a comprehensive array of life-saving resources. When your everything needs everything, turn to HCMC. More at hcmc.org/pediatric-trauma.
Back to the conversation now, Chris Farrell and Fiona Gregg. Fiona, my apologies for mispronouncing your last name there. I'm sorry about that, but thanks for correcting. Fiona Gregg, Director of Consumer Research for J.P. Morgan Chase Institute. And Steph, I said that we would tweet out the study that they've just done. Are you way ahead of me on that?
I have it posted, which is easier for everybody to get to, since not everyone's on Twitter. It's at nprnews.org/live, and it's a great read.
Let me grab a call here from John in Minnetonka. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Doing well. What are you thinking about on this?
Well, about a year and a half ago, I left a 33-year-long career working as a youth pastor,
mm-hmm.
and I started a nonprofit that helps youth pastors find work, because increasingly veteran youth pastors are leaving, for whatever reason they're leaving their churches, and then they're having a difficult time finding a church that can afford to hire them at a veteran pay level. And so I know the church I left, two full-time people and an intern left, and they replaced them with one part-time person because of the cost of health care.
So the gig economy has even entered religious institutions here, which I wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for the call. Chris, I wanted to ask you about some of these suggestions from Senator Warren in this speech that she called Strengthening the Basic Bargain for Workers in the Modern Economy. She essentially is calling for a redesigning of the safety net that we were talking about that's there for full-time employees and not for these kinds of workers. What do you think that should look like?
So if you're taking over a longer period of time and you think about your career and you think back, most people lose their jobs, they take other jobs, they adjust to their careers. And so longer term, I think most economists would agree, we need to move toward a system where the health insurance package and the retirement system is attached to the individual rather than through the employer. Because it's a very odd artifact of the U.S. system that if you lose your job, your family loses their health care coverage. Now, I know you can use COBRA, but nobody can afford COBRA if you've lost your job. And then you no longer can contribute to your retirement savings plan because you got that through your employer, and now you have to roll it over into an IRA, and hopefully you don't spend it. So I think as this contingent workforce grows, as there's growing emphasis on self-employment, as there's sort of a sense of talent being less attached to a particular company but more attached to their career or their profession, that there's really a sense that if we're going to embrace this gig economy, and I'm using the gig economy in kind of like the broadest sense of that term, if we're going to move toward this gig economy and actually tap into a lot of the promise that's there, then we want to be moving toward a system where the benefits are attached to the individual. So in Switzerland, for example, once a year, you choose your health insurance. There are 99 insurance companies, and they have a package, but it's attached to you. You don't get it through your employer. That's the system, and I think this is what everyone's kind of trying to discuss, trying to move toward that kind of a system.
Fiona, is what Senator Warren is suggesting really necessary, given what we've said about how people are using the gig economy right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're already seeing, actually, that aspects of this social safety network, including retirement, maybe aren't sufficing. In fact, we looked at seniors and found that even seniors are participating. So roughly 1% of seniors are earning income from the gig economy, compared to 3% across the whole population. But even more interestingly, they are relying on it for a higher percentage of their income. 28% of their income comes from labor platforms, compared to 26% among all ages. So seniors are not shying away from participating in the gig economy, which may already be an indication that the retirement savings that they've accrued and other safety networks that they have aren't sufficient.
Right. Yeah. What does that tell you, Chris?
Well, I think exactly right. I mean, And particularly, it makes a lot of sense if you're 65 and you probably file for Social Security and you're on Medicare, so you have your universal health care right there. And then the gig economy is a way of supplementing your income, because one of the things that's nice about the gig economy, when you think about self-employment, and we had earlier a call from Marcy, mm-hmm. and her network and going out and getting jobs and getting work. I mean, the nice thing about a lot of the gig economy is you turn on this online platform and the customers come to you. And so I think a lot of people who have had their careers, they want a little variety, they want a little flexibility, they need to be earning an income, but the kids are out of the house and they have their Social Security, they have some retirement savings, they have Medicare. The gig economy actually is an incredible resource for an aging population.
John and McGregor says, given the pervasiveness of the gig economy and that some people have been working in it all their lives, would it be possible for these people to get taxed differently than other people who work 40 hours a week?
Well,
I don't know about the potential of that.
There you run into the issue of our tax system's already too complicated. Mm-hmm. And there have been some ideas. It used to be, and I can't remember when this was changed, I believe during the Reagan administration. It might have been the first Bush administration, that you could average out your income over 3 years, and which was a real benefit for the self-employed, for people who had lost their job. And that was taken away. So there's always ideas like that that are out there. And of course, if you're self-employed, you can offset a lot of your expenses and deduct them on your taxes, a lot of business expenses. But the tax code is complicated enough as it is, and it's controversial enough. I mean, just listen to this conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
What's a contingent worker? What's a gig worker? That I just think everyone will shy away from that.
Kathy on Twitter, I've been asked by my part-time employer to become a contracted employee. Timely conversation for me. Step off the page.
One, I want to just point out that over and over people say, my spouse provides my benefits. Spouse provides my benefits. Brendan says, I've been a freelance commercial photographer for 10 years. I'm lucky that I get health insurance through my wife. This work arrangement has allowed me to be home with our children. I found that people who are looking to earn some quick cash on the side bring down the profits for those that are operating as a real business and are paying taxes, business insurance, and licensing. And one problem I found is that I don't want to be left out, but the emails and back and forth with designers on projects take time, and my clients don't always understand that my time needs to be compensated.
Fiona, one of the things that I wondered if you investigated with your report was some of the collaboration and the creativity that's coming out of this. I was reading about this coworker.org organization. They use an online platform to organize workers who are usually not in one place because they're gig workers. Were you seeing some development of that?
Oh, well, I mean, one myth I would like to dispel with the data that we have is this idea that people are cobbling together a livelihood off of many different platforms and are kind of shifting from one platform to another and maybe collaborating in that way. Among our sample, we saw only 14% of people were using more than one labor platform, mm-hmm. and only 1% of people were using more than one capital platform. And all told, only 2% were using both labor and capital platform. So, I think this space might be a little bit more fragmented than we might have imagined, in precisely because of the diversity of opportunities that it presents.
Kathy says on Twitter, been freelancing since the kids were born, now would prefer to work out of the house part-time. Those jobs don't exist. To the phones to Lacey in Little Falls. Hi, Lacey.
Hi.
Hey, what's your experience on this?
Well, I have been working as a contract employee for about 5 years now, and I'm in a similar situation. I had a daughter, and now I'm looking to possibly get back in the workforce. I actually have an interview coming up for a full-time position, and they're looking to contact my current employer sort of as a reference.
Huh.
And
huh.
I'm left in a position where, because I don't have any type of protection, they would possibly cancel my contract if they knew I was looking for something else.
Oh, boy. So what are you going to do?
Well, I have been in contact with the executive search agent, and I sort of explained that, and he seems to sort of understand, but I know I'm in competition with four other people for the position. So if they all have great references from an employer, I might be at a disadvantage.
I didn't think about this, Chris, how the potential full-time employer sees giggers, right?
Right. So I think in that sense, I think most employers are going to be positive for two reasons. One is, if you're a gigger, you're out there hustling.
You're a self-starter.
Right? You're a self-starter. Yep. And a lot of employers like that, and they want a more entrepreneurial bent among their employees. And they're always trying to come up with ways to encourage more innovation, more creativity, more entrepreneurship. So I think this story fits right in there. And quite frankly, right now, the way the labor market is going, this is a good time to be trying to make that transition. You have employers out there complaining about, you know, skill shortages, and they can't find the right people. And the advantage that a worker like her has is they demonstrated the skills to their employer. So I think she's in a pretty good position despite this little quirk on the reference side.
You know, Fiona, I felt like I skipped over what you were saying about older workers in the gig economy. Do you have what was the percentage you told us of senior workers that are doing this?
Yeah, so 0.9% of seniors were providers in the platform over a 12-month period. That compares to 3.1% of the general population. So they're there. I mean, you know, not as quite as robust as the millennials in terms of the percent of people who are active, but they, as you know, what I mentioned was that they are actually earning a higher fraction of their income from these gigs than, say, millennials or younger people. So on the labor platform side, the platform income represents 28% of their income compared to 26% for everybody else, you know, the non-seniors. And same is true on the capital side, where seniors, you know, 65 and older are earning a higher fraction of their income, roughly 12% compared to 11% among the rest of the population. So although they are, you know, fewer seniors are participating as a fraction of the total, among those who are active, they are relying on this more heavily than the general population.
And here was my curiosity about that. Haven't seniors always supplemented, or, you know, in more recent decades, supplemented their for investment income and Social Security income with these kind of freelance gigs? I mean, now it's digital, so we can see it better. But do you think this is something unusual?
Well, you know, we did look at the percent of income that's coming from labor, you know, from the labor force in general for seniors, and that percentage is 25%. That has been increasing. So it was roughly 21% in 2009, and now it is 25%, you know, in 2015. So I think, you know, this is part of a larger trend where seniors are extending their careers. They are retiring later in life. So it may not just be just a gig economy thing. It could just be that they're, you know, staying in their 9-to-5, you know, their primary job for longer, in addition to adding gig income to that.
Fiona, really glad to have all your insight from the report in the show. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Chris, I wanted to ask you about that because I know you're focused on that part of kind of what the encore years that we talk about. Now, you're an advocate of saying to people, wait, if you can, wait until you're 70
right.
to take your Social Security. This seems like kind of the perfect answer.
It is.
That.
It's a very good answer. It's one. It's part of your arsenal of options in order to make that practical to wait. Because, you know, if you don't have income coming in, you can't wait till age 70.
Right.
And the only reason why I say age 70 is not because I'm Simon Legree or someone that wants to torture you. And
right.
But it's because your benefit at age 70 is more than 75% greater than your benefit if you filed at age 62. And from age 66 to age 70, you're getting the equivalent of an 8% inflation-adjusted gain for every year that you delay.
Okay, here's my question for you then about that. Do you think more companies, as employees reach their 60s, might – I mean, are we seeing maybe an opening for companies to say, if you retire – we still want to keep the relationship going, which I know happens informally anyway, but yeah, more
but
formal.
But more formal. So you're going to platforms like Kelly Services. Companies are turning to Kelly Services or Manpower, and they're saying, look, we want our employees to be able to come back. They can't work more than 960 hours a year,
okay,
so we don't get into any kind of labor market trouble, and you handle all the paperwork for us and the workman's compensation and, you know, the withholding and all of that. But managers have a form they are saying, oh, someone's going on vacation, or we have a project here, or we need some marketing expertise. And they go to their boomerang retirees, and they're coming back. And this is a growing part of the labor market.
I mean, I think that's a I think there's a real upside to that, right?
There's a tremendous upside because you maintain that flexibility as an individual. If you're retired, you don't want necessarily to be working 40, 50 hours a week anymore.
Right.
And you don't necessarily want to be, you know, spending as many hours around, you know, your colleagues as you were before. But you want to make some money, and it's very comfortable to come back because you know how the computer system works, you know how the key card works, you know where the coffee is, and there are people there that you like, and you know how to do the task.
For you and the employer.
Exactly. Yeah. It works for both sides. It's a win-win situation.
Steph, did you have something off the page you wanted to share?
Yeah. Mark is working after retirement. He says, following 3 decades of work, I'm now retired, and I've taken on a call job. He's in a call center. He says, it's working fine for me. He says, but I observed the considerable demands on the supervisor. He spends a lot of time putting together our workforce. Is there time considered in the overall assessment of cost savings? If, you know, like putting together a gig economy must be tough for companies.
Yeah. To the phones to Aaron in St. Paul. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I'm late for one of my gigs right now. So I'll be quick.
Okay.
I just kind of, not to be Captain Bringdown, but I have been working in this kind of economy for about the last 15 years. I'm a single parent. Right now I have a per diem position at a hospital, and then I have a sort of a contracted position with another place. And as a parent, it is very, very difficult just in a lot of different ways. My kids are lucky they have health insurance, and I do too. But it's really hard to ever just, it's hard to take a day off, even for kids' appointments.
Right.
If I ever tried to take them on any type of trip or anything like that, it's really hard to just relax because I'm like, hey, okay, everybody have $150 worth of fun because, I feel like
that's what I'm losing if I'm not doing my gig, right?
Exactly. So it's very hard to relax. And I had bronchitis for about 2 months. Because I felt like, well, if I take the morning off and I go to the doctor, am I going to feel $200 better? I don't know.
Wow.
As it turns out, I did feel $200 better once I was treated. But it is a pretty stressful way to grow up. My daughter is always saying, Mom, just quit your jobs. Just have one job. And I'm like, right, I would love to have one job.
It just
isn't going to happen.
Aaron, I'm really glad you called because I didn't think of the kind of the thing that ticks away in your head, Chris. Time off means lost money. And you probably calculate that in a really different way than you do in any other kind of job.
You do. And just as she said, talk to anybody that's self-employed, gig economy or other forms of economy. There's always that stress of, well, who's my next client? What's my next job? What am I going to be doing? Something falls through. And a lot of us don't have that much of a support network. And your friends and your family, hopefully. But it's a stressful way to live for many people.
Chris, thanks. Good to have you here. Chris comes in every now and then to talk about the way we work, which is a topic that we like to chat about here on the show. Next week, the Workologist is going to be on with us. You know him, Steph. Do you remember
Rob
him?
Rob Walker.
That's right.
He's a
Rob
wonderful
Walker.
Guest. I really like him.
He fields a lot of great questions about work. So more conversation about the way we work coming up next week. If you miss any of these discussions, politics, science, books, work, 21st century kind of issues that we cover a lot on the show, you can find them on the podcast, NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes.